Okay. So tonight's topic is going to be what I wrote about understanding the halachic implications of the siren, not the siren that we sometimes get here for rocket attacks. God forbid, we shouldn't have any more of those. But the standard siren that goes off in the entire country of Israel for Yom HaShoah and Yom HaZikaron. And it's interesting, and you might think that it's just, there's no questions about it, but it happens to be that there are one or two issues that are discussed a little bit. The main reason why this became a big debate here in some circles is because in the Haredi world, many, many people do not stand up for the siren, they don't acknowledge the siren, they just keep walking, they keep doing whatever they're doing. And other people get very upset about that. They say, well, they have obviously nothing to do with the rest of the country if they couldn't care less about the fact that either for Yom HaShoah that we're commemorating, people, 6 million Jews that died in the Holocaust, or Yom HaZikaron, the soldiers that gave their lives for the country, and they couldn't, they just keep going on doing their own business or even scoffing at it and saying it's ridiculous. It's been a bit of a debate, so I just wanted to explore the one or two points of why they are against doing anything for the siren and what the halacha responses would probably be. There are basically two issues. I mean, the main issue that they'll quote you.
Oh, halachic responses to their reasoning.
Yeah, to their problems. Meaning they don't, obviously some of it comes from their anti-Zionistic stance. That's obviously the case. But at the same time, they will quote you a concept, which is the one that we'll discuss.
There are defined rabbinic days of national mourning, such as Tisha B'Av, which is why they don't do Yom HaShoah.
Okay, so that's right. So that may be, that's a bit of a different question, which is also worthy of a shir. That's not the shir we're going to do tonight, but that's definitely a question.
Well, is there a distinction between rabbinic versus secular? Or
yeah, I mean, there's one issue when it comes to Yom HaShoah, which is really a very similar issue to that, which is raised for Yom HaTzmaut. It was one of the issues of Yom HaTzmaut, which is, can you make another day of something of significance, let's say, on the Jewish calendar? So for Yom HaTzmaut, that's a happy day, it's a celebratory day. For Yom HaShoah, it's a day of mourning, as Kevin mentioned. So the question that's raised there, and this is already mentioned in the by the Chazon Ish, actually, in one of his letters. So he's against the concept of Yom HaShoah because of the fact that he understands that you cannot make any extra days on the Jewish calendar. And in addition to that, also we already have Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is already our national day of mourning. Why do you need to make another day of mourning? Rav Moshe Feinstein, again, we're not going to go into this now either, but Rav Moshe, when he's talking about Thanksgiving in America, he also brings in one or two of the Makoros that deal with that question. In terms of making a religious holiday, there's a Ramban in Parshas Veschana, which seems to indicate that maybe you can't add any extra holidays to any extra dates as significant to the Jewish calendar. There's one or two other things also. So that's one issue which is brought up with the Yom HaShoah, that maybe you can't make an additional date. In terms of that, again, that wasn't really the topic of my share tonight, but that's the responses would be that that basically we're not making a religious, we're not giving the day religious significance, okay? We're taking a day on the calendar, and we're saying this is going to be the day that we are going to commemorate the 6 million Jews that were murdered in the Holocaust. And, it's not necessarily adding a date on the calendar, which is a religious date. It's basically an arbitrary pick of a date, which, we observe by...
But I understood not to be a dating question, whether or not there's a halachic question as to whether or not you can add a date or subtract a date on the Jewish calendar for celebration or for mourning reasons.
Right.
But rather than the rabbinic instituted a date, halachically, for all things that are related to mourning.
That's also true. I mean, they're both true. I think that the Chazon Ish's point, I think, was more focused on adding days to the calendar. But together with that is certainly the assumption that Tisha B'Av we already have as a national day of mourning. Nevertheless, again, the idea was that many, many people felt that Tisha B'Av, sort of, if you just have that, then it sort of swallows up the Holocaust and the severity and how much we lost in the Holocaust, that you can't properly commemorate what happened and all the people that died in the Holocaust if you only mourn for it on Tisha B'Av. So if you find a way to take a separate day, we're not saying that this is not related to Tisha B'Av, and that's, again, one of the things that people bring up, that when you have a separate day, you sort of lose track of the fact that Yom HaShoah really is related to Tisha B'Av in that You know, the only reason why these things are happening is because we're in exile. We've been thrown into Galus, the base of Mitzvah was destroyed, and we haven't merited to get it back yet. And really, it's all one long chain of, you know, tragic events for our people through history, with including the Yom HaShoah, including the Holocaust. Even though the Holocaust was obviously a much greater magnitude in most respects, but at the end of the day, it's still connected. That's one thing which many people say is left out when you make Yom HaShoah a separate day. But I think in terms of that, you can definitely say that if it's understood that Yom HaShoah is definitely, you know, included in this chain and ultimately, you know, comes back to the point of the Jewish people in Galus and subject to our enemies. But at the same time, again, be able to acknowledge the fact that this really is a tragedy of much greater magnitude than anything else. And it really does make sense logically that it really would get swallowed up. But if we just had it on Tisha B'Av, you really wouldn't be able to really commemorate properly all the people that lost their lives during the Holocaust. And therefore, again, it's, even if maybe it's not something we would have automatically done from a halachic perspective, but at least it's understandable. Certainly understandable and probably worthy of commemoration, and it is commemorated in many, many places in the Orthodox world as well, as an important day of commemoration on this day. So, again, that's a partial treatment of that part of the issue. Again, there are other questions also. They talk about when it comes to Nisan, the date that was chosen is Chafav Nisan, which is the month of Nisan is problematic in terms of saying Kamal Rachamim. The halacha is that you're not supposed to say Kamal Rachamim and Hespedim during the month of Nisan, and yet it's done. Okay, so it's done. The reason again why it's done on that day is because that was the day that the Warsaw Ghetto that the fighters were where I think the revolt was put down. Is that correct? That's right. Remember? Who was that? I don't know, it's definitely connected to the Warsaw Ghetto, the fighters in the Warsaw Ghetto. I just can't remember if that was the day that they were. I think it was they were. I think that was the day that the revolt was put down by the Nazis. But that's why they chose that day. And again, halachically, it's not the best day. But at the end of the day, any question of saying Kamal Rachim is a very, very minor issue. Halachically, it's not a major, major issue. Again, those that would want to be mocked, it doesn't mean that you don't have to commemorate the rest of the things on Yom HaShoah, even if you wouldn't say a Kamal Rachim. It doesn't necessarily mean you can't take away the rest of it. Anyway, that's again, a very, very brief, so some of the issues that come up with Yom HaShoah. The issue that I wanted to focus on more was the issue of the siren that I mentioned to you before, which is really both applicable for Yom HaShoah and as well as for Yom HaZikaron, which is another week afterwards. So the issue that comes up here is a very interesting one. That's what people will tell you, is that it's a problem of Chukas HaGoyim, okay, that you can't acknowledge a siren standing up for 2 minutes and being silent or whatever, because it violates the prohibition of Chukas HaGoyim, violates the prohibition of acting or adopting Gentile practices. And now you may ask, well, what in the world are they talking about? Okay, where did they get that from? So the answer is, you know the answer? A siren is not a Jewish practice. Okay, you look in Jewish tradition, you look at halachic sources, you look at anything. Jewish, you will not find use of a siren in this type of form. Maybe you have other kinds of things in the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan of trumpets, chatzotros, and shofar. But in terms of mourning, you won't find a siren in this modern use. You won't find it being a Jewish practice. It's basically something which came from the Gentiles. I think, I forgot exactly when it was used. I checked this once. I think it started sometime in France. Somewhere in France. At some point, I don't remember exactly when it was in history. Do you have wireless here? You can look it up if you want. But somewhere in France, that's when the concept of using a siren to demonstrate mourning, national mourning began.
Warsaw Ghetto Uprising.
Right, but what point of the uprising? The beginning of the uprising or the end of the uprising? That was the question. I don't remember. Huh?
Anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising.
Right. Okay, so that's the day that they actually revolted. That's what it was. Anyway, so the sirens started again. I think sometime in France.
Beginning.
Who's that?
Beginning.
Okay, that was the beginning of the uprising. Let's see here. And in terms of the sirens, again, you have this question: Is that mean it's a problem of Chukas HaGoyim? If it was started by Gentiles, does that mean that it was something which would be halachically a problem? All right, so we'll read here. I wasn't going to discuss this tonight, but it's already in front of me here, so we'll just read the paragraph here from it's from Wikipedia, but it's, you know, just regular information. Basically, they point out here that the that the Knesset decided it was in 1951 when they made, I'm sorry, Chav Zayin Nisan, as Yom HaShoah. That ignored the rabbinate decision from 2 years earlier, who basically the rabbinate had made Tisha B'Av as being the date of remembrance for Holocaust victims. The rabbinate afterwards in turn decided to ignore the Knesset's chosen date, one reason being the fact that Jewish law forbids fasting and certain laws of mourning during the month of Nisan, which we mentioned before. And they mentioned also the Chazadish we mentioned before, that nowadays we do not have the power to institute new days of mourning or commemoration of future generations. That's what we said. While there are nevertheless Orthodox Jews who commemorate the Holocaust and Yom HaShoah, others in the Orthodox community, especially Haredim and Hasidim, remember the victims of the Holocaust on traditional days of mourning, which were already in place before the Holocaust, such as Tisha B'Av. And he pointed out a number of Rabbanim actually wrote kinos to be recited on Tisha B'Av, which we often say. If you look at many of the Sidurim, they have these kinos from Rav Schwab, Rav Bubber Rebbe, and Rav Weissmandel, all mentioned kinos on Tisha B'Av. Currently, we have here in Israel the Asara B'Teves, which is one of the more minor fast days. That's used in Israel today as being the fast day which commemorates the Yom HaShoah, because it's not quite as significant as Tisha B'Av in terms of the restrictions, but it still recognizes obviously an aspect of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, so they felt that that's more appropriate. Right afterwards, they point that here, while most modern Orthodox religious Zionist Jews do stand still, Haredi areas no attention is given to Yom HaShoah. Most stores do not close, schools continue, and most people do not stop walking when the siren sounds. The non-participation of Haredim and Yom HaShoah is one of the points which regularly causes friction between Haredim and non-Haredim in Israel, as non-Haredim consider the Haredi position of ignoring the siren and Yom HaShoah altogether to be disrespectful. Okay, so that's basically the issue here. And again, obviously it has some political and some philosophical basis, as I mentioned before, of being anti-Zionist, and anything that the government does, or even if Yom HaShoah specifically is not directly related to the government, more Yom HaZikaron is more, but it doesn't matter, anything the government institutes, you know, there many, many Haredim will be against. But again, they will point you, as I mentioned, the main halakhic issue that they'll point you to is Chukas HaGoyim.
That's the only one?
Excuse me? The other issue that some will mention, especially if they're in Kollel or learning Torah, is that it's Bittul Torah. Okay, how can you stop in the middle of learning and, you know, have a siren? So we'll get that a little towards the end. I guess we'll just mention that for 2 minutes. But the main issue is really Chukas HaGoyim.
Let me understand. They're saying that the issue of Chukas HaGoyim overrides any other form of, I don't know, you say Hakarat HaTov or recognition.
If it's done in a distinctly non-Jewish matter.
It's not the issue of the remembrance of what happened to soldiers or whichever they were talking about.
Right.
It's just the way it's being commemorated.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I mean, again, you know, what would happen if they had a different day? So again, there still would be people that would be against it because of the Tisha B'Av point we mentioned. But in terms of the Chukas HaGoyim point, you know, they probably wouldn't have as much of a problem with it. They might ignore it anyway because of the government. But that's not a halachic reason. That's a reason why, a Zionistic, anti-Zionistic reason. Mm-hmm. But those that know something, and many of them will quote you this, that's a little bit more ridiculous to just disregard, because the government, even if the point is a very important and significant, you know, valued concept, here they'll say it's usur. Okay, we can't stop. We, not only do we not want to stop, we can't stop because it's Chukas HaGoyim.
I'm just saying that, say, Haredim in America, they will, I don't know, Thanksgiving is an important day.
Most of them, well, many of them don't celebrate it.
Don't.
But there again, it's a bit of a different issue. Though the truth is, you're right. Chukas HaGoyim does go through both those issues. Yeah.
A bit of a fuzzy thing.
100%. You're right. So some of those are similar overriding themes. You're going to Haredi areas, and Thanksgiving is not specifically observed by many, but you will have. Put it this way, it's not quite as, you know, people are not quite as against it because it's not Israel, so it's not an Israeli government doing something. They're not, people just, okay, it's the American government, they don't have to stop. Being in Israel, it's a national rule that everybody's supposed to stop for the siren for 2 minutes and stand up and be quiet.
But then in that case, yeah. If you move a couple of women, well, that's like a completely good,
yeah, but there, nobody's forcing you to go into your house and eat turkey on Thanksgiving. You know, it's not anything, it's a holiday which people observe, but you can do whatever you want. You know, here, you know, the entire country.
Was that? Because it's in the news. It's.
But it's not just that. I think it is. People, you are supposed to. You know, you are supposed to. There's one practice which is basically accepted by the entire country to do during those 2 minutes. Thanksgiving. It's not like there's one practice that everybody does at the same time. So it's a little different. But in terms of the halachic point, you're right, though. Meaning halachically, you're right. That is, the issue of chukas of goyim is absolutely the same issue for both. The way that we apply it may be a little bit different, but the issue is the same. So we'll go through some of the makoros very briefly, and the source sheet. So I'll just try to do it outside, and you'll see how things come out. You know, whether it really makes sense or not. So just be aware, this sugya in the Gemara and the Rishon is a little bit complicated, so we're not going to go through most of the complicated details, the technical details, but even just the way that the sugya comes out is a little bit tricky, which makes it hard to learn through it carefully, the way that we often would. But I'll just give you very briefly the two Gemaras. Essentially, this sugya is a sugya where you have two Gemaras. Okay, the two Gemaras seem to contradict each other. It's not clear exactly... the context of each is different, but they seem to somewhat contradict each other, and then you have different opinions of how to resolve it, which are also, again, not so easy to understand. And then, in terms of the halach, it's pretty straightforward of what the different opinions are about it. So very briefly, basically, the two Gemaras are like this. Okay, one Gemara is talking about, is in Avodah Zarah. Okay, it's in Avodah Zarah, Daf Yud Aleph, where they're talking about how you can commemorate the death of a king. All right, and apparently, they used to burn things. They used to burn certain objects to commemorate the death of the king. That was one of their practices of mourning. Okay, so the Gemara goes back and forth about this, whether this is okay or not, and whether this burning is considered what they call a chukah. Chukah here in this context means a rule which is problematic in terms of following non-Jewish practices. Okay, so the Gemara seems to assume that it's okay because the Mishnah there talks about it being okay, and the Gemara asks, well, why is it okay? How could it be? Isn't it a problem with chukas agoyim? And the right answer is that really, that burning, you know, for a king is not considered to be chukas agoyim. It's a strafa lav chukahi. It's not considered to be a rule or a law. Rather, it's what they call chashivusahi. It's something which is significance, meaning it's something which is importance, meaning you're demonstrating the fact that you are upset that the king died. It's not something which is, you know, a rule that the non-Jews always do this for no, you know, for idolatrous reasons. Okay, basically, originally chukas hagoyim was something which was understood as, you know, things that the non-Jews did, which was based on idolatry. Okay, so here what the Gemara seems to be saying is that burning for kings was not a paganistic practice. It wasn't something they got from the idol worshippers. Rather, it was something which demonstrated their, you know, chashivus. So it was significance and honor given to the king that passed away. So that's what the Gemara says in Avodah Zarah, that burning objects for this in commemoration of the king that died is not a chukah. It's not considered to be a violation of this point. That's one Gemara. The other Gemara is in Sanhedrin, on Daf and Beis. And here also, it's a bit of a different context here in terms of certain cases of chiyuv misa. And how you're obligated to put people to death that have violated certain criminal prohibitions in the Torah that would require capital punishment. So basically the Gemara brings in the same case here of the burning things for the king. Okay, basically the way that the Gemara does it here, again without getting into all the details, is basically the question is how to accomplish the way of what's called saif. Okay, saif is basically decapitation, right? There are certain, again, prohibitions that if you do them, you're chayav misa. And you get decapitated, your head gets cut off if you do them. And the question is exactly what the exact technical procedure, which way is the head cut off? Which way do you actually cut off the head? From which direction? So there's machlokas here between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, and apparently Rabbi Yehuda believes that the issue of chukas agoy may be relevant here because the non-Jews may do it in a certain way. And therefore he says, how can you say XYZ because it's a problem of chukas agoyim? And the Chachamim answer, well, once the Torah says you're supposed to do saif, so we don't care what the non-Jews do anymore. Okay, and then they point out this case of the burning for the kings. Okay, and he says that's also a problem of chukas agoyim. And then they point out basically, well, the reason why it's not chukas agoyim is because of a pasuk in Yirmiyah, which points that to the fact that maybe they actually burn things when people die. Okay, the pasuk is in Yirmiyah, Perek Lamedal of Misrafos Avosecha. Okay. So basically what this Gemara is saying is that any case where you have the Torah telling you to do something that you can do something, then even if it's something which is also an idol worshipping practice, the halacha will still be that it's permitted. Okay, I mean, if the Torah says that this is the way to do it, then we don't care if the Avodah Zarah people do it also. So essentially what you have here is two different Gemaras dealing with the same issue. Two different issues, but they both bring in the same point of burning for kings, and both of them say it's okay, but the reasons they give are different. Okay, the first Gemara says the reason why it's okay to burn for the kings is because it's not considered to be chukas goyim in the first place. It's considered to be a practice demonstrating the significance of the king. And the second one sounds like, really, it is chukas goyim, but the fact that it's mentioned in the Torah as being a legitimate practice of burning things for when people, important people die, or kings, when kings die, so therefore, we also would say that it's permitted when the Torah mentions it. But if the Torah doesn't allow it, then it sounds like it would be problematic. Okay, if the Torah doesn't say it's okay, then it sounds like it would be a chukas agoyim. So the Rishonim figure out here how these two Gemaras fit together. And again, the answer is a little tricky. I'll just give you the tip of the iceberg here for some of the Rishonim that will be helpful for us to understand our issue. So Tosos, again, we're not going to read inside. It's a little tricky. Basically, he says there are two different kinds here, two different kinds of chukas agoyim. Okay? He says, again, it's going to be hard to even plug this back into the Gemara, so we're not going to completely plug it back, but just to get the concept of what he's trying to say, basically he says there's one concept of chukas agoyim which is done for idol worshiping purposes. Okay, it's basically done as avodah zarah. Okay, and there's another one which is done for the purpose of what he calls das hevel v'shtus shalohem. It's not done to worship idols. It's done because it's silly or ridiculous. Okay, and basically. Both of them are problematic. I mean, both of them are usher. Okay, only if it's not done as something which is chok hevel v'shtus, it's not done as something ridiculous, then maybe it would be okay. Again, then Tosfos try to figure out how those two concepts fit into the two Gemaras. Right. It's not so simple to figure that out. Okay? It's not so easy to just plug it back in. So we're not going to actually plug it in, just because it gets very technical and very complicated. So, but just understand in terms of the concept, that's what Tosfos develops. That there's these two different ideas of chukas agoyim: A being idolatry, B being chok hevel v'shtus, a silly concept, and that's how he wants to plug in how the two Gemaras work their use their concepts. In any case, based on that, okay, I'll just take it one more step before we can go to the next sheet. So basically, the extra step that he adds in, which again partially answers the Gemaras, is that in the case where it's written in the Torah, so in that case, if the Torah says that. Let's skip that. That part is also a little bit complicated. I'll get that out. Basically, in most cases, Tosa says it's going to be. It's not something which is mentioned in the Torah. It's definitely going to be usher, both as avodah zarah as well as in a case where it's chok hevel v'shtus. Okay, the Ran in source number 7. We don't have a source sheet. The Ran of avodah zarah disagrees. Okay, the Ran understands a little differently. He says, and again, he seems to be focusing more on one of the two Gemaras. He seems to be focusing mainly on the Gemara of avodah zarah, which talked about the idea that if it's something which is used as idolatry, it's problematic. But in that case, it was chashivusa. So he says, based on that, again, he seems to ignore the other Gemara. He seems to pass it straight on the Gemara, one of the two Gemaras. He basically says that the Torah only forbade cases which was actually idol worship. Okay. He says that the Torah only forbade chukos shel avodah zarah, eilu dvarim shel hevel u'batal. Okay, these ideas of idol worship are hevel u'batal. Okay, they're things which are basically totally not worthwhile and totally null and void. And he says that all those things, basically, in the Gemara of the sort of the burning case are for the purpose of avodah zarah, but he says dvarim shel ta'am sharu. Okay, something which has a reason is permitted, and therefore the case of burning for the kings has a reason. You're doing it for their kavod. Okay, so that's basically his idea that anything which it has a good reason why it's done. It understands what it is. Not even sanctuary. Torah. Just if there's not even Torah, not a Torah sanctuary necessarily. Okay.
Just it's logical to person to do such a thing, right?
Yeah. So basically, it sounds like he's distinguishing between a chukas avodah zarah and something which is dvarim shel ta'am, which has a reason.
It's very different. Okay.
Probably right. Yeah, so it's probably different than what Tosfos says, because he says that varm shel ta'am, something which has a reason, is permitted. So you have to figure out in every case whether there's a good reason or not. But he says the case of the burning for the kings is a good reason because it's for their, you know, for their kavod. The only question about the Ran is just that he, when he's talking about the Avodah Zarah part of it, he adds in that this is something which is Dvarim Shel Hevel Ubatala. Meaning, in addition to mentioning the point of Avodah Zarah being idol worship, he also says that it's something which is Hevel Ubatala. Hevel means nothing, and Batala means, you know, nullified, means not worthless. So then the question would just be, you know, what does that mean? I mean, he has on one side he's got something which is idol worshiping practice and something which is Hevel Ubatala. I mean, he's describing the idol worshiping practice as being Hevel Ubatala. On the other side, it's Dvarim Shel Tam, something which has a reason.
Hold on, you're saying that Hevel Ubatala is.
I'll read you the language. I'll read you the language. He basically says, in the case of the Sorfan al Malachim, burning for the king, says, Lefishalo Asra Torah El Chukah Shel Avodah Zarah. The Torah only forbade rules or things or practices which are based on idol worship. Elu Dvarim Shel Hevel Ubatala. These are things which are Hevel Ubatala, which are, you know, worthless. The Kulan Yeshban Sorah Avodah Zarah. And all of these cases in the Gemara there are things which are necessary for Avodah Zarah. So he sort of lumps them all into one. Mm-hmm. As opposed to Dvarim Shel Tam, something which has a reason, is Shor, that's permitted.
Okay,
so you have to just figure out what those words Hevel Batala are doing there, but overall, seems that he's probably saying that idol worship practices are problematic, and maybe even something which has no reason, but something which has a reason, Dvarim Shel Tam, which has a good reason for it, is permitted. Okay? That's what the Ran says. When you go into the Halacha, so... I'm going to have to read this inside now. The Rambam gives in Halachas Avodah Zarah Perek Yedal, so he gives a little bit of an overview of Halachas Avodah Zarah. He says that you can't do things which the non-Jews do. You can't look like them in any way in terms of what you dress, how you dress, which again is another shir. Very, very interesting. But he says that the Jews should not be like non-Jews. Jews have to be separate and recognizable and distinct in terms of their actions. Okay? That's basically the Rambam's concept of Chukas HaGoyim. What comes down in the later Rishonim, this is the Maharik, okay? One of the later Rishonim, who's mentioned in the Beis Yosef, and so in Kufayin Ches and Yoradeya. So basically what he does, as he wants to say, and again, what he says is very, very similar to the Ran. Basically, he says that the only time that Chukas HaGoyim is a problem is like this, okay? Number one, if it's something which has no, Asher Ein Tamo Nigla, we don't know the reason for it, meaning the reason is not revealed. Okay, he says chok. The concept of a chok is something which is like, you know, zot chukat haTorah for parsha, you know, parah aduma. So you don't have a reason. That's what Rashi says. That's how we all know that a chok is opposed to a mishpat. Chukim are things which don't have reasons. He says here also chukas hagoyim has to be something which the reason has not been revealed. Okay, since you're doing something unusual and there's no revealed, you know, obvious reason for it. Okay, just that the non-Jews do it. The non-Jews have a certain practice. We don't really understand why. It doesn't really make so much sense. Okay, then. He says that if you do the same thing, it seems like you are following their practices, and that's not good. Okay, then you're basically looking like the non-Jews, which is exactly what the Rambam said is usher. You say this is the Maharik, okay, of his first name, Kolon.
That goes nicely with Tosfot.
Hold on. Let's finish it up first. Okay.
Right.
So then he says, he says, if there's no good reason for it, if there's no revealed reason for it, so then he says, why would you do that? Okay, and then he says the second reason is anything which is something which is which has elements of pritus, okay, and removal of tznius. Okay, if it's something which involves pritus on the goyim have done it, so that's also something which is problematic. So the shaila that he dealt with there was basically, can you have certain very specific kinds of dress? The specific shadow is actually can doctors wear white, you know, white coats when they go in the, let's say in the hospital or in their, you know, to do their do things that doctors do. Is that problematic? Meaning where did they come up with this thing of that doctors wear white, you know, white lab coats or whatever? Who knows? Do you know? I don't know where it came from. Why did they come up with that specifically? What's the reason why you have to wear a white coat? Okay, does a white coat specifically make you sterile?
No.
Not at all, right?
Yeah.
So, basically he says, though, that that in that case he thinks that is mutter, okay? He says the only time there will be usher if it's a dress which is distinctly a non-Jewish dress, okay? And because of tznius or other reasons, Jews have specifically tried not to do it. But here he says it's not a distinctly non-Jewish dress, and there's a reason for it. And the reason is that even though you can ask, well, why does it have to be white? Why does it have to be so and so long? But the idea is to distinguish the doctors so that people know which people, you know, who the doctors are. Okay, you know, that person is a doctor, whatever he's going to do. I don't know if it makes it better or less, you know, more understanding, whatever it is. But that's the reason why it was done, even if it doesn't explain the details of why it had to be white or this and that. But the concept of wearing a white coat is a concept which can be, you know, somewhat understood. And therefore, he thought that was mutter.
So it's not, that was not going to fall in the category of chukat hagoyim.
Correct. Ma'arik says it's permitted. Okay, that's basically what he says. Okay.
That's so you're able to give it some sort of logical, rational, reasonable, motivation why it's done.
Right. That's basically what the Maharik says. Okay. That's something which is what he says is mutter, and that's how the Ramah passes in the Shulchan Aruch. Okay. The Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Kuf Ayin Ches basically says like that Maharik that it's that is permitted. He says. Gives one or two examples here, and the way you phrase it is like this. This is the Ramaz quote now. Okay, something which has a minug of the non-Jews, which is nagu l'minug l'chok ve'ein tam b'davar. Okay, there's no reason for it. De'ikol lemechash be'mishum darchei amori. You have to be concerned that maybe it's darchei amori. V'sheish bo shemet avodas kochav miyavosev. Maybe there's avodas are involved. Okay, but something which is nagu l'toeles, which is done for a good reason, for toeles, for productivity, for a benefit, such as the doctor issue where they have a special type of coat or thing that they wear to show everybody that he's a doctor, it's permitted. Okay, v'chein shows mishum kavod otam acher. You do something for kavod or for another reason. That's considered to be permitted, and that's why burning for the kings is mutter. So now, just to understand the Ramah, what the Ramah seems to be saying here is like this. Okay, again, this is based on the Maharik. Okay, that something which is done for to'elis and has a good reason, okay, is permitted. Okay, therefore, again, the doctor case is permitted, the burning case is permitted, that's fine. Something which is done, or dress which is worn, where there's no reason that you can figure out, you don't understand what the reason is, okay? What's the problem? The problem is not the fact that you're doing what the non-Jews do. The problem is we're afraid that maybe the original source of that is idol worship. Okay, it's avodah zarah. That's the difference between him and Tosfos. Okay, according to Maharik, that's what we're really bothered by. If you don't know why the non-Jews do something a certain way, you have to be concerned that maybe originally it came from practices which were avodah zarah, and therefore it's certainly not appropriate for a Jew to do. Okay, but such as the case of the doctor with the white coat, do we understand why the coat has to be white? Why it has to be down to your nose or whatever it is? No, not necessarily. We don't understand that. Well, and maybe there's no good reason for it, but the fact that it's clear what the overall reason is means that it's not something which you have to be worried about avodah zarah, and therefore it's something which is it's for to'elis, it's for some sort of good reason, and therefore it would be permitted.
It just sounds like it would have been more reasonable to not call it chukat ha'goyim, but rather call it chashash avodah zarah.
Well, chukat ha'goyim, originally the Gemara was called darchei ha'amori, okay, things which the Amorites did.
Oh,
which
are, so that's really what
yeah.
it is. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Great.
Okay, and that's based on the pasuk of uvuchukosayim loselechu. Okay, you shouldn't walk in there. Chukos.
Yeah.
That's actually not this week's parsha, but next week's parsha. Okay, it's in Acharei Mos Kedoshim, uvuchukosayim loselechu, and that, there the context is idol worshipping societies
okay.
in Eretz Yisrael.
Okay,
so that's basically how they're going to work it out. And again, that's basically probably what the Ran is saying. Also, we mentioned before that the Ran said that anything you know, the Torah forbade things which are idol worshipping activities, which are things which are varshal hevel batala. All the activities are something which has needs for avodah zarah, and therefore those are usher. Things which are dvarim shel tam are permitted. So based on that, you know, it sounds like you would probably say anything which there's a chance that maybe it came from avodah zarah practices would be problematic. Anything which has a good reason would be okay. As opposed to Tosfos, Tosfos seems to be saying that even if it's not based on avodah zarah, okay, but it's clearly not idol worship or based on idol worship. Still, it's going to be awesome if it's something which doesn't make any sense. It's just ridiculous. Okay. Now, again, there may be different definitions here about what that is.
Otherwise, you would be able to say it's not a Vodazara, but it's also...
Right, exactly. Okay. Meaning the choke that wash the doctors wear white coats, yes, we understand that they are wearing, that they're showing that they're different, but choke hevel v'shtus means, well, at the end of the day, you know, why does it have to be white? Why does it have to be that dress specifically as opposed to something else? You know? So it could be that Tosfos would say that's problematic. Okay, that's going to be again a bit of a question how to understand Tosfos. But Lamaisa, according to the Ramah says clearly, like the Maharik, that anything which has a good reason for it is going to be permitted, and only things which are you know potential questions of avodah zarah is going to be usher. Okay, that's what the Ramah is going to say.
Is there anything from the Shulchan Aruch?
Anything from the Shulchan Aruch? The Ramah is commenting on the Shulchan Aruch. All the Shulchan Aruch does is quote the Rambam. Basically says that you can't follow Chukas HaGoyim. Ein Holchim Chukos Ov De Kochavim. Okay? You can't follow non-Jewish idolatristic practices. And you can't make yourselves imitate non-Jews. And you shouldn't wear clothes which are unique to the non-Jews. Then he talks about how you grow your hair, etc., etc. You shouldn't build Jewish buildings the way that they build idol worshipping buildings. Today would be the example would be to not build a shul the way you build a church would be a good example.
What's that?
Say?
What about building?
So again, that's a question. Generally today it's usually somewhat accepted, but that at the same time they don't build shuls exactly the same way, even maybe a somewhat similar style in terms of the whole place, the whole culture of that location is a certain way in terms of how they build their architecture.
Yeah, every kind of architecture.
That's also true. Today's churches are all, that's correct. So today is not really such a...
But I'm looking back and historically, if you take a look, if you go to Florence, for instance, and you take a look at the church, the central church, the big dome in the center of Florence, right? The only other thing that you can see in the skyline that's actually somewhat prominent is the shul.
Right.
It's a very similar architecture.
Right, right. So that's right. So that's probably not... that's probably not necessarily included in that way. I think that they would probably...
The buildings also, the Mishnah buildings were built very specific structures, which are I'm sure the church of the...
Yeah, or not. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's probably more in terms of where we're trying to be separate here. Just to mention one other important opinion, the halacha, and that is the gra. Okay, meaning Tosfos is not really quoted so much by the Bacharon. Okay, the Bacharon do not seem to pass like Tosfos. Okay, the Maharik, we said, is mentioned in the Ramah. The other opinion that's mentioned is the Vilna Gaon. Okay, the Gra came up with his own idea here. Okay, he didn't like the Ran. He had problems with the Ran's explanation. He says that the Ran doesn't explain the two Gemaras. The Ran explains the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which says that in the case of the burning of the kings, that's permitted because it's a Chashivusa. He says that makes sense. But he didn't explain how to deal with the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which says that the reason why it's Mutter is only because it's not because the Torah says. The Tanakh has examples of burning with kings, but if not for that, and in the other case, it sounds like it would be Osir. So that seems to go against the implication of the Gemara of Avodah Zarah. So basically, what he says, the Gemara says like this: Elavade Devade Hakol Osir. Everything is Osir. I mean, anything initiated by the non-Jews as a non-Jewish practice is Osir to do for Jews. Rak Dafka Lil Mod Mehem Osir. Okay, meaning even just the fact that you learn to do something based on what the fact that the non-Jews did it is already Osir. Okay. And he explains basically, it came with Dechsiv, Lo Minayo Gamrinin, Velo Dami, Vishim Dechsiv Araisa, etc., etc., etc.
How do you reconcile that with something like Yeshchach Vilna
Goyim? One second, we'll get to that in a second, we'll just make sure we understand the Vilna Goyim's opinion first. Basically, what he says, basically, the bottom line is anything which the Torah talks about is probably okay, and that's how he explains the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Anything which the Torah mentions is permitted, but what he means by saying everything of theirs is usher. Anything shahayinu osim zuba sam mutar. Anything that we would have done without the non-Jews would be permitted, including things that the Torah mentions, which is the case there of sorfanal malachim. That's permitted, but okay, in terms of clothing as well, anything that we would have done without them in terms of clothing or other things is permitted. However, according to the Gra, he says that anything which would not have been done if not by the Jews, if not by the fact the non-Jews had done first. He says anything like that is usher, and that's going to fit with both Gemaras. That's going to fit with both Gemara and Avodah Zarah and Gemara and Sanhedrin. Both of them, can agree with that point. That that the case of the burning of the kings may be mentioned in the Torah, and it may be Chashivusa, but any case which was not mentioned in the Torah and wouldn't have been, initiated by Jews had the non-Jews not started, he says is going to be usher. That's going to have very far, wide-reaching implications if you follow the Gra. Okay, if you follow him, you're going to have lots and lots of things that. Yeah, do they make sense? Absolutely. But would we have thought of them on our own? Not necessarily. One interesting example of this could be, certain types of clothing. Let's say, again, clothing, you have shirts and pants. All right, so it's possible, Jews would always wear something along the lines of the non-Jews at some point. But what about a tie? Why do you have to wear a tie? Who thought up the idea of a tie? What does a tie add to your dress? Would Jews have thought of wearing a tie if not for the fact that non-Jews were wearing them? Probably not. According to the Gra, and there are those Hasidim, if you look today, there are those Hasidim that are very careful not to wear ties because it's the Gra or it's the Hasidic approach. But something along these lines, what'd you say?
What about strangles?
So that's another good question. But at that time, it could be that they, you know, that they would have thought about it on their own. So anyway, I don't know. Good question. I don't know. Have to ask them. But a lot of things that non-Jews do that the Jews never ever would have thought of on their own. Certainly, you know, according to the Gro, would be Osir. Now, again, what do most of the Achronim say? So most of the Achronim agree with the Ramah. Okay, if you look at most of the Achronim, and Rav Avadya Yosef has a tshuva about a different issue. He talks about putting flowers on top of a grave.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with this.
Yeah.
So he goes through, you know, his classic style, you know, 25 pages or whatever it is, going through all the different sheetahs about this thing. He basically shows pretty conclusively that the majority of Achronim agree with the Ramah. Okay. And therefore, the Vilna Gaon is not necessarily the mainstream opinion on this issue. However, again, depending on some of the issues, that question also, in terms of flowers on top of a grave, okay, that's not a Jewish practice to put flowers on top of a grave. We talk about maybe putting stones there are other things, but not flowers. So therefore, you know, it would seem to be, he points out, it would seem to be that issue of flowers and the issue of the white coats for the doctor and any of those kinds of things would be also according to the Gro, because they're not things that Jews necessarily would have thought of had the non-Jews not thought of them first, even if it makes sense, even if there's a reason for it. Okay? Rav Avadya, of course, disagrees. He says, you know, we don't pass them like that usually for the Vilna Gaon. It wouldn't be a problem in that case, and certainly in the case of the doctor it would be okay. Anyway, again, I cut a lot out here. There's a lot more to say about these points and a lot of interesting back and forth. But that's basically the bottom line in terms of some of these opinions here. Based on that, again, you have a lot of different interesting nafkaminas which can come up, which we're not going to really deal with them all now. But one interesting area is again in America, Thanksgiving is a big question we mentioned before. Okay. Can you have a day of Thanksgiving? And again, this may depend on which opinion you follow. If you follow the Ramah, it sounds like, you know, you could say that it makes sense. There's a good reason why you would celebrate Thanksgiving. According to Tosos, maybe not. Maybe Thanksgiving might sort of make sense. But Chok Hevel V'Shtos, well, why do you have to eat turkey on Thanksgiving? Okay, yeah, because it's not a word. Who knows what? That's a silly reason. So according to Tosos, that might be problematic. But, you know, overall, the concept of Thanksgiving seems to be appropriate. According to the Gro, absolutely not. Okay. Flowers on top of the grave is the same thing. In terms of the sirens, we're just getting to our issue, so probably, though again this is not absolute, but probably it would stand to reason that the same machlokas would apply. Okay? Meaning, according to the Ramah, there's a very good reason why people stand up on Yom HaShoah and Yom HaZikaron. Okay, the point of the siren is to show respect, to commemorate all the people that died. Everybody stands up in the country at the same time and listens. Silent thought, silent commemoration. Yom HaZikaron is the same thing, you know, for soldiers that have died. Absolutely, it's a Dvarim Shel Tam, for sure. Okay, for Toelis, it's definitely absolutely gets people in the right frame of mind to commemorate the fact that so many people died. That definitely makes sense, as opposed to the Vilna Gaon. The Gro probably would say no. Again, as we mentioned before, the siren is not a Jewish concept. It's not something the Jews necessarily would have thought of had the non-Jews not initiated it. And therefore, the Vilna Gaon might say that it's problematic. What were you saying?
For the Ramah, you have to also, I'm trying to understand it, but you also have to say conclusively that there's no connection to Avodah Zarah.
Right, so I think it's clear for the siren that it was not an idol. Yeah, I don't think it was Avodah Zarah practice. Again, you know, we'll look on Wikipedia if you want. If I have it here, I could look up also.
You think it started off in France?
What did you say? I think so, yeah, I think that's what I remember saying. Okay. You have to check at that point. I don't think the French were idol worshipping anymore. Anyway, so that's the story here. So again, if you follow the Gro, so then already I could hear that this is something which is that would be problematic. But if you're going to do that, you got to be consistent, and there are going to be a lot of other things also that you're going to have to machmir for chukas agoyim that you may not even realize. You know, might be things which are started by non-Jews. You know, who knows what? Anything which, you know, Jews wouldn't have come up with on their own in terms of practices, in terms of clothing, in terms of anything else. You know, are going to be things that might be awesome. And again, what did you say?
Technology.
That's an interesting question about technology. You know, technology is not specifically a non-Jewish practice, but yeah, you could think about that. Other things, I'm sure you can come up with a lot of other things. So that's again a question. But you know, according to the Ramah, the mainstream opinion would seem to be that it would seem to be okay. So again, if they quote you the Gro, so again, you could say, yeah, truth according to the Gro may be problematic. Rav Yehuda Henkin. So his wife is the head of Nishmat.
Wow.
So he has a tshuva about this also, actually, in his Sefer B'nei Banim. That's the Sefer that he wrote He's the grandson of Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin from New York, who's the head of Ezra's Torah, the one of the Gedolim in New York, Moshe Feinstein. That's his grandfather. His father, he quotes him all the time, and he studied with him extensively. So Rav Henkin in Bnei Banim in Chelek Aleph, so he has a whole chuv about this. So he basically says the same thing. He wanted to even argue, I don't remember exactly why, I think he wanted to argue that even the Gro would agree that the siren is okay, because the commemoration, I don't remember exactly what he said, but maybe because the commemoration is something which is important, okay, to demonstrate that the fact that we want to show the people that died and mean something to us is important. Maybe the Gro would agree as well. Again, I don't remember the exact details of why he thought the Vilna Gaon would agree, even though the siren itself was a non-Jewish practice. I don't remember exactly. But he wanted to say even the Gro would agree. But aside from that, again, you would say that that if you really follow the Gro and Chukas Hagoyim for every, or the Gro for everything else, then maybe you could be machmer here without a problem. But again, that's questionable whether people really follow the Gro in every other area aspect of Chukas Hagoyim. Rav Henkin also does with the other point I mentioned before. We'll conclude with this about Bittul Torah. Okay, people that say, "Well, I don't want to learn Torah. I don't want to stop learning Torah." It's interesting. When I was in Shalavim, I don't know what the other history yeshivas do. You remember from Karen Biavna? That's what you meant, right?
He stopped.
Say again? He stopped, right. So in Shalavim, I think what we did, I think they still do this, is they basically stopped about 15 minutes before the siren, and everybody learned Mishnayos. I mean, they learned Mishnayos, Lezecher, Nishmas, either Yom HaShoah or Yom HaZikaron, I forgot exactly which thing, but they were already in the mood, they were learning Torah, but already in the mood of something which, they used the opportunity to do something slightly different, but still to in the Torah realm to create this this type of commemoration. And basically what Rav Henkin says is, yes, it's true that there is a question of Bittul Torah, and somebody quoted the Mishnah Pirkei Avos, which says that if you say that this tree is very, very nice, then if you're walking on the way, you're traveling, and you say Mana Ilan Zeth, tree is nice, you look at the tree on the way and you stop when you're in the middle of learning Torah and you say the tree is nice, then Mischai V'Nafsho, you're a chayav misa, so to speak. Okay, your soul is obligated, is to be killed. Which again is obviously is figurative. It's not literal. But so he deals with that. He says this. He says that maybe this is different because anytime you have to stop for anything else, that's Bittul Torah. And there it's a little different because there might be a question of danger when they were traveling in places which didn't have people, which weren't populated. So that was Torah was protection from danger. He says maybe this is different. Again, he has a few makoros to prove that point. And he says here also what he calls Nimusei HaMedina. Okay, however you translate Nimusei HaMedina. Okay, that the country is, the country has a certain practice that people do, and people do that, and you stop because everybody else does, because that's, it's considered to be, good sense. So that's not necessarily included in the same case of Mischai B'Nafsho. And he says, if you're really worried about Bittul Torah, so you can learn Torah in your mind also. Yes, it's true that maybe learning Torah out loud is better, but people that learn Torah always have a few minutes in between here and there that they think about what they're learning rather than just speak. It can't be otherwise. You have to sometimes process. You got to think. So he says this is no worse than that. And certainly, if you want to be makbid on the Torah, so you'll think in your mind for the 2 minutes of the siren, whatever it is, you'll have in mind something that is Torah related. So it won't be a complete bittul Torah. But he says certainly that would be it's certainly permitted, and he thinks it's important to stop for that. The Eretz Chem Tshuvas. This is from Torah Tzidbitz. My earlier man, which is, I don't know which year it was, but somebody asked him about this. He said, the question was, I am disturbed by the refusal of some religious Jews to stand for the siren on Yom HaZikaron, and the same thing would be true for Yom HaShoah. Someone told me it is forbidden to do so, and it's forbidden to stand for the siren. If this is so, why doesn't the rabbinic come out against it? If not, shouldn't all religious Jews stand? So he goes through again the post we mentioned here, and then he mentions at the end, he says that in our case, the mark clearly met. Anyone who has experienced standing at the siren as the whole country stops everything together, silently contemplating the sacrifice and contribution of the fallen Kedoshim, knows how effective a remembrance it is. It is thus fully logical and permitted. And they point out afterwards that it's also a chil Hashem not to stand, especially in public. Okay? So if a few people don't stand and just go do what they're doing, that's really more of a much more of a chil Hashem. Than the other, which also would create a problem. He says, we feel that one most effectively deals with conflicts among our people with love, not, for example, by yelling Shabbos. For the sake of consistency and desire to make things better, not worse, we urge that this disagreement be handled with love and understanding, not mudslinging. Right, that's his conclusion there. So basically, to conclude, it seems that there is some sort of halachic basis in terms of both of those points for, you know, the practice of people that don't stand for the siren. But at the same time, it seems that that's not necessarily a mainstream approach, and probably in the mainstream halacha should not necessarily be accepted. It seems that halachically, according to most posting, it's perfectly permitted and probably recommended and appropriate to stand and acknowledge the siren in some form, even if it means thinking about Torah if you're in the middle of learning rather than speaking out loud. You know, the value and the importance of commemorating both Yom HaShoah and Yom HaZikaron, at least in the concept, even if you don't agree with the day so much, but the concept behind it, and especially the idea of just standing together with the rest of the country, maybe with the rest of the people, is a very, very important idea, which should be taken, I think, taken very seriously. Okay, any questions? Okay.